Welcome to another episode of Locked In Science. At least for the time being, we are still locked in. We are still social distancing. And boy, are we having a great time in this. What is our distributor's studio. You could think of it like that. Claire, Stu, how are you coping?
Oh, you know, the weeks just seem to be flying by, don't they, Chris?
They certainly are weeks, Claire. That is true.
If not flying by, then generally blurring into one another, I think.
Yeah, I think that might be the better way to look at it.
Yeah, it could be a speed blur, like a motion blur, or it could just be everything kind of oozing out.
A miasma of weeks.
Yeah. A sourdough starter of weeks. Throwback to my last show.
A SCOBY of weeks.
A SCOBY of weeks, yeah.
So we have an excellent show, though, lined up for you this week. Claire, what have you got to surprise us with?
Well, this week is a special week because we have a special guest with us, Marie Gertz, who is a professor and head of nursing at the University of Melbourne. And she is with us because we are celebrating International Nurses Day. It is on Tuesday, May 12th, every single year. But this year it's special because not only is it International Nurses Day, but I don't know if you knew this, 2020 is International Year of Nurses and Midwives. So that's even more special.
I knew it was the International Year of Plant Health. Could this be a combined thing? Plant nurses?
Nurseries? No. The nurses and the midwives need their own celebration, Chris, I'm afraid.
Separate the nurses from the nurseries.
Yes, there's definitely needs to be some separation going on there. And the reason it's a whole year is being dedicated is that it is 200 years since Florence Nightingale was born. And Florence Nightingale, pretty much the she professionalised nursing. So Marie's going to talk us through a little bit about how she did that and also, you know, what nursing is like in 2020, especially with the backdrop of COVID-19.
Great. And Stu, what have you got?
Well, look, there's a backlog of news from outer space this week.
So you're saying that space hasn't stopped working even though there's a global pandemic. Does it not stretch that far?
No, absolutely. You know full well that space goes on and on and on for a really long way, possibly infinitely. We don't really know. But there is a lot of space news, and I'm going to jam it all into the show this week. All sorts of stuff's been happening from you know, actual regular old scientific research to all sorts of weirdness from the Pentagon. And, oh, look, just hold on to your hats because this one's going to blow you away.
Hold on to those tinfoil hats. All right, then. Well, on with the show.
This week marked International Nurses Day on Tuesday, May 12th. Of course, this is a special event in any year, but this year it's even more important, with 2020 being the International Year of Nurses and Midwives, all happening during a global pandemic, which has brought into sharp focus the vital role of nurses at the front line of healthcare around the world. To talk to us about why the world needs nurses now more than ever, I have with me Marie Gertz, Professor and Head of Nursing at the Department of Nursing, the Melbourne School of Health Sciences at the University of Melbourne. Marie, welcome to Lost in Science.
Thank you.
So, Marie, it is International Nurses Day this week. What does this day symbolise?
So International Nurses Day is obviously celebrated every year, but this year, as you mentioned already, it is particularly important because what we're doing this year is commemorating 200 years since the birth of Florence Nightingale, who's widely considered to be the founder of the modern nursing profession. And so each year we do talk about the importance of nursing, but this year we particularly want to highlight the value that nurses play in terms of public health and the delivery of healthcare to populations. And the important role that they play in the pandemic is a coincidence, but actually an important coincidence, because they are the people who provide healthcare to populations over 24 hours a day, you know, so they're the people providing the surveillance of patients' health status. So they're frontline workers. They work as part of an interdisciplinary team. But importantly, they're there to provide comfort and care to people and to use the science that they have. They study at a high level now in universities, and they understand applied science and humanities, and they use that in their work with people to ensure that they get the best possible care. And so in Australia, we're very fortunate that we have a highly skilled nursing workforce. And relative to other parts of the world, it is true that the nurses in Australia are able to provide the levels of care that they need to. That is not the case in all parts of the world. So in many parts of the world, there are shortages. There's a global shortage of nurses at the moment. And so we wanted to highlight that particular issue. Why? Because of the expansive work that they do, the increasing growth of the population generally, and the ageing nature of the workforce, the nursing workforce, and they are the largest profession that provides healthcare. So technology is evolving all the times, and medical treatments are developing. But we really need nurses to be delivering that frontline care and making sure that people are safe.
Now, Marie, you mentioned it's been 200 years since Florence Nightingale was born. I'm curious, in your opinion, looking back historically, what would you say has changed since then, and what has stayed the same for nurses?
Well, let's start with what has stayed the same, and perhaps some of the legacy of Florence Nightingale. I think that's a really important thing to remember about her. She was a young woman when she went to the Crimea, and she really contributed in three very, very important ways which remain very pertinent to us today. And the first one is really in infection control in hospitals. So she was an early subscriber of what we call sanitary science, which is a broad science. Of course, back in those days, little was understood about viruses in particular or bacteria. But what she did understand, and what people at the time understood, or enlightened people of the time understood, was that there was a link between disease and uncleanly conditions, unsanitary conditions. And so she was a great proponent of basic hygiene, hand hygiene, keeping people clean and keeping environments free of filth, which was obviously a big issue in the Crimean War when she visited there when she was a young woman. And she systematically adopted systems. So she used her influence to adopt systems to provide a clean environment for people, to ensure that nurses washed their hands and physicians and surgeons washed their hands. These principles were absolutely fundamental to turning around the mortality and morbidity of people on the front line. In fact, it was thought that people died more from the battles, the injuries sustained in battles, but actually many more died from infection. So she had an important role there, and she developed systems for infection control. So another thing that she did that was important was that she was a highly educated woman, as a matter of fact. She studied statistics and mathematics, and she used her abilities as a communicator and her understanding of mathematics and the observations that she made in these hospitals to affect change, to influence change and make hospitals safer places for people to be cared for. So that was the second thing that she did. And finally, the other thing that was important about Florence Nightingale, she was a great humanitarian. So she really cared for the people that she looked after, and she was hands-on. as all nurses are, she appreciated the importance of providing psychological care for people who didn't survive. And she played an important part because she did encourage patients to send messages that people that wouldn't survive to send messages to the families to provide comfort to the families. So those are all things that are obviously very important to...
Very fundamental to nursing today.
Yeah, so those are the pillars of nursing practice today. So the second part of your question, you were asking about what's different. And, of course, technology and our understanding of disease has evolved remarkably since those times back in the 1850s, of course. We understand much, much more about viruses and bacteria and disease, and we have much more sophisticated ways of protecting people from infection and safeguarding the community. But still those fundamental pillars remain. And the nurses today are still predominantly women, but we do have an increasing number of men, which is good for having diversity for populations. But we also, we have the technology to monitor physiological parameters very, very closely. So people like Florence Nightingale would have been looking intuitively at patterns and observing patterns in people, changes in respiratory rate, work of breathing and those kinds of things. We still depend on those, but we have many, many more monitoring tools in our armoury.
I mean, nurses around the world are on the front line of this global pandemic. Many of them are risking their lives to provide care for patients. Is this the most dangerous time to be a nurse?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I mean, nursing is a risky profession. There's no doubt about that. Even before the pandemic, you know, nurses do face various challenges to their safety, but they do have skills also, and they have techniques, and they work together to manage those risks. They are highly educated professionals. Yes, it is risky, but there are many safeguards within the system to support nurses and ensure that they are cared for in an appropriate way in terms of their occupational health and safety. Now, that's the case in Australia. Again, I mention the Australian context because it isn't the case in all parts of the world. We are very lucky to be in this country in regards to the health response that we've had, to be able to flatten the curve and manage the pandemic in the way that we have. But we're also very fortunate because we have a very robust health system. And even though there have been shortages in personal protective equipment and things like that, the governments have worked together to make sure that those safeguards are in place for health workers, including nurses.
So, Marie, 2020, as I mentioned, it's also the International Year of the Nurse and Midwife. What community understanding and appreciation would you like to see come from this year?
So we know that nurses are appreciated by the community, and this year is really about highlighting the value of nursing work, not just for the sake of it, but because we need more nurses. We need more people and we need diverse people from the population to aspire to become nurses and to undergo nursing education, because nursing is critically important to the attainment of good health and good population-based health for the entire world. So our interest is partly to recognise, obviously, and pay tribute to an amazing workforce who are well deserving of the accolades, but more importantly, to attract good people into nursing to make it a career and enjoy the rewards of the profession in terms of the scope of what you might undertake, in terms of research, in terms of clinical practice, and in terms of education.
Marie Gertz, thank you so much for joining us today. And, of course, a big shout-out to all the nurses out there working very hard. And, Marie, I hope you can come back on Lost in Science and we can talk a little bit more, hopefully after the pandemic.
Thank you. It's an absolute pleasure.
Science, the final frontier.
These are the voyages of Lost in Science, our ongoing mission to explain strange new words, to seek out new science and new explanations, to boldly go where no radio has gone before.
A lot of us have had not a great deal to do lately, for obvious reasons, and staying at home trying to entertain ourselves when we've watched everything remotely interesting on every streaming service can be a little bit tricky, but at times like this, we look to one of the oldest watching experiences. We watch the skies. Now, obviously, astronomy is interesting enough at any time, figuring out what constellations you can see from where you are, or looking at the rise and the set of closer planets is a fascinating pastime. And, you know, I've got an app that tells me where planets are, and I always find that amazing.
It is. I mean, even tracking the moon or being a bit more in touch with where the moon is in its cycle during isolation has been a nice upshot.
The moon is one that you can actually track from home quite easily. You don't have to go out into a remote field, which could be, I don't know if that's one of the excuses allowed for leaving your house. Officer, honestly, I was just going to look at some stars. I don't know where that will work.
If you're an astronomer, it counts as work. If you're not, it might be a harder sell to the nice police who come to arrest you. But, you know, there's also things like satellites, like the ISS flew quite close to Melbourne the other day and a lot of people went out and saw that.
That'd be the International Space Station, wouldn't it, the ISS?
Yes. Yeah. Yes. And you know, there's apps and things that can tell you where that is and other satellites as well. You can look up and see all sorts of things. There's also objects that we can't identify that sometimes appear. And some people have been very excited that the Pentagon has released footage of some unidentified objects from their archives.
Are they just unidentified, Stu, or is there another adjective you would put in there?
No, I'll stick with unidentified because they sure don't know what they are.
But they're flying,
they are
right?
They're unidentified flying objects, which
all right,
is...
That's all? That's
yeah.
All?
That's what UFO means, and the Pentagon have said, yes, yeah. Here's some footage of UFOs that we have. Have a look. Check it out. See what you reckon. Because they don't know what it is.
I believe the modern term is unidentified aerial phenomena.
Yes, that is...
Which kind of gets away from the flying object thing. That could be anything.
Well, that's the other thing about UFOs and unidentified flying phenomena is... There is all sorts of reasons that things can look like they're moving fast and objects that appear to be actually there are not really objects. They may be tricks of the camera or tricks of other things and various other phenomena, as you say, that could explain what these things are. But look, go and have a look. You're not going to have any trouble finding the footage. It's all over all the news services right now. But some people are going crazy that the Pentagon's admitted there are UFOs. They've always admitted there are UFOs. There are UFOs. That just means they're unidentified flying objects. They haven't been identified. So go identify them. Knock yourself out. It's a great way to spend your time if you've got a lot of time on your hands. Now, obviously, there are unidentified objects that turn out to be things that we can explain. Now, a man in regional Victoria who's a pathologist, for some reason, has lots of time off, which didn't really make sense to me. I would have thought pathology was in demand right now, but no, he had a lot of time off. And he's up in Swan Hill, up in the northwest of Victoria, and he identified something in the sky, which he reported, and it turned out to be a new comet.
Hey.
So it's called a Swan comet. There's been a few comets identified which have this designation of Swan, but the naming conventions mean Michael Matiazzo, who actually identified it, doesn't have the honour of naming it for himself, as he discovered it using one of NASA's satellites called Swan. So basically, he just pored over the satellite data and identified this comet and said, "Hey, I think this is a comet." And then NASA went, "Yeah, it is. We'll call it after our satellite that you found it with."
We'll Thanks, take that, Matt. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Michael. Yeah. Now, it's not visible to the naked eye. but you can see it with a decent telescope. There's another comet at the moment called Atlas, which was, according to the rules, named after the Atlas telescope, which discovered it. Astronomers were watching that one, and they thought it was going to give a really good show. You know how they have the big long tail coming out as they get closer to the sun? Except as it got closer to the sun, the solar wind broke it up into lots of tiny little pieces, and there was nothing to look at. So they were a bit disappointed by that, by the Atlas comet. But, you know, they're watching the Swan comet now and you know, getting a bit of joy from that observation. Now, other astronomical events lately, the Eta Aquarid meteor showers, which are pretty much a seasonal thing. They can be seen from late April through to May.
If any of our listeners saw them, took some photos, it would be wonderful to see and send them to lostinsight@gmail.com, please, because...
And we'll show them on the radio.
Yeah, we will show them on the radio.
Well, at the very least, we can tweet them and post them on our Facebook page. But, yeah, if you see anything, even if you don't know what it is...
Aerial phenomena.
Unidentified aerial phenomena. That would be amazing. Now, on a larger scale, the Eta Aquarid meteors are quite small. Obviously, they fizzle up in the atmosphere and they're gone. On a larger scale, a 2-kilometer asteroid came very close to the Earth at the end of April. It was only 6.3 million kilometers away. That's pretty close.
That's quite close.
Yeah. The same asteroid will be back in 2079. It's going to be even closer. It's going to be 1.8 million kilometres away. So, nail biter when that comes back.
It's like the Terminator of asteroids. I love it.
Yeah. We should get up there and spray paint. I'll be back on the... on the side of the asteroid.
I'm sure they've got plans for that.
Yeah, it's on NASA's to-do list. The object is classed as a potentially hazardous object, but all that means is it's within 5 million miles, according to the people who give them these classifications, or about 8 million kilometres of Earth's orbit. It doesn't even have to be near Earth. It just has to be within the realm of Earth's orbit. And is the size limit for these potentially hazardous objects is 140 metres. So this is much bigger than some of these potentially hazardous objects. But it's unlikely to hit the Earth even, you know, at any point in the future. These objects have very predictable orbits. Even bigger than a 2-kilometre asteroid, the closest black hole to Earth has been observed by astronomers at the European Southern Observatory in Germany. But it's only a baby as black holes go. It's only 40 kilometres across. Tiny, weeny little black hole.
Mm.
How much does it weigh?
As much as it weighed when it was a star, so...
Yeah, I think it's about 4 times the sun or something like that.
But, yeah, condensed down, so it's now a black hole. Now, some researchers think there might be even closer black holes than this one, but unless they're near other objects, you can't really see black holes. They're, you know, notoriously black because they suck in all the light that happens to be nearby them. So this one is in orbit with 2 other stars, which are probably about the same age as the one that's turned into a black hole. And the other stars are in the same orbit because, like I said, it's got the same mass as it did as a star. It's just a different sort of arrangement of that mass. And these are very young stars, according to the reports from the astronomers. Our sun is about 4.6 billion years old. That's 32 times older than these stars. So they're only 140 million years old. So they're just little baby stars, really. And 15 million years ago, one of them went supernova and turned into a black hole. Hasn't actually affected the other stars much. They're still in this three-way dance orbit around each other. And they're not close enough to be really affected. They just get a bit of a wobble caused by that star. But they're affecting, caused by the black hole. They're affecting the black hole as much as the black hole's affecting them, if that makes sense. So they're all sort of interacting with each other, but they're not going to get sucked in by it or anything like that. Now, even though it's the closest black hole anyone has detected to Earth, it is over 9,500 trillion kilometres away from Earth. So it's not really going to cause us any issues at any time. And even though that we know it's there, it's not like we can, you know, send out a space probe to investigate or anything like that.
I believe these stars are visible from the southern hemisphere without a telescope. So it's close enough that you could see it if it was visible.
Yeah. Still lots of stuff going on in space and, just so many things that have been off the radar lately because of other obvious reasons. I just thought I'd catch us up on some of the big space news and some of the small space news. Stay tuned for more space news on other episodes of Lost in Science.
That is it for another episode of Locked in Science. Thank you to Professor Marie Gertz for telling us all about nursing over the last 200 years, but particularly in this time of global pandemic. And thanks, Stu, for telling us all about what is coming to us from above, be it unidentified phenomena, meteorites or black holes. I'm sure there's nothing to worry about. Lost in Science is, of course, recorded in Melbourne at the homes of Claire, Stu and Chris, normally at the studios of 3CR. It airs across Australia with the Community Radio Network with the support of the Community Broadcasting Foundation. I should say that we are recording on the lands of the Kulin Nation in Melbourne. We'd love you to get in touch with us. Send us your pictures, your astronomical and otherwise. Actually, just the astronomical ones mostly. But if there's anything else that you want to say to us, you can email us at lostinsci@gmail.com or you can find us on Twitter. We are at Lost in Science 1. We're also on Facebook. We are Lost in Science on 3CR. We are on your podcast apps. If you're on an app where you can rate us and review us, that'd be great because that helps other people to find us. Or you can just listen to us on the various radio stations where at the same time every week, Claire, Stu and Chris get
Locked in Science.